This election cycle has been an unusual one for Johnson County, where incumbents usually get to sit pretty for a little while, but this go around, just about every office is up for grabs. And one thing that sets a candidate apart from another is where they stand on non-discrimination ordinances, which several Johnson County municipalities are discussing right now. They'd protect the rights of LGBTQ residents and housing and employment in particular, because currently no such protection exists at the state or federal level. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And as part of our series checking in with reporters and editors of community newspapers, we're going to hear from the editor of the Shawnee Mission Post, where these elections are the big story right now. Jay Center, good morning.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being back. Explain in a little more detail what makes this election cycle different from what you've seen in the past.
Well, traditionally in Johnson County, a lot of times when you get to these local elections for city council, governor, city council, mayor, offices like that, the incumbents will stand for re-election and not face a challenger. This election cycle stands out because in especially some of the larger cities in the area, you've had incredibly active election cycles where you had primaries for city council seats. And as we're heading into the general election, Overland Park and Shawnee in particular, you see pretty much every single race that's on the ballot is a contested election.
So let's dig in with Shawnee and Overland Park. So these are the two really interesting ones with so much activity going on around them. What makes each one so active?
Yeah, and just to kind of as a point of juxtaposition to show that, you know, this isn't across every city in the area. The city of Leawood, which has 30,000 people in it, you had the mayor and five or six, I can't recall, members of the city council up for election. All the incumbents stood and none of them were facing challengers. Next door in Overland Park, all six city council seats that are up for election this year have challengers, and three of those seats had primaries.
What do you think is the difference?
Well, the city's have been facing kind of different issues recently. In Overland Park and Shawnee, you've had a lot of questions about economic development in recent years. In Overland Park, you have had people kind of raising their hands and starting to question the city's tendency to grant tax finance incentives to developers when they want to build something in the city. It's kind of become de rigueur for developers to come request millions of dollars in tax abatements, exclusions, things like that, even when they want to build a development in a green field. Traditionally, those tax incentive packages are reserved for redevelopment, trying to reinvigorate places that are kind of getting dilapidated. So you've had residents getting more and more concerned about that in Overland Park. Overland Park has also had some crime issues in the northern part of the city. Earlier this year, there was a string of pretty high-profile violent crimes all hitting the same neighborhood within the course of a matter of weeks. And so you have residents stepping up and saying, listen, you know, as the city continues to develop and grow south, we need to make sure that the parts of the original parts of the city in the northern part are still safe, attractive, livable, things like that. So
it's interesting because the issues that you're describing in Overland Park anyway are several. There are many of the issues that people within the more urban parts of Kansas City have been talking about. Like those have been the political issues on some level in Kansas City, Missouri for a while.
Right. Absolutely. And so and that has not escaped notice. Right. So Overland Park is a suburb. Right. I mean, it's a sort of your prototypical suburb. It's also a huge city now. It has a population of 190,000 people. I believe it's the second largest city in the state of Kansas. And it's also getting older. So some of those issues about aging infrastructure, neighborhood stability, the things that have been on the radar for Kansas City, Missouri voters for years and years are starting to become big issues in Overland Park as well.
Yeah, in a new part of town, you're not going to have questions about redevelopment. You have those when a place has been around long enough.
Absolutely. And you know, downtown Overland Park, for example, it is in the midst of a total transformation. This is a area that had sort of a bunch of mom and pop shops along Santa Fe Drive, not a ton of housing around the area. There were single family homes all around.
Quaint is a word you might use.
Absolutely, yes. And in the course of the past couple of years, the city has given the green light to a number of multifamily projects, mixed-use development projects, new offices for downtown. So you see cranes and construction crews all over downtown Overland Park right now. Some people in the area were not huge fans of that transformation. Other people are saying, you know, it was time. We need this reinvigoration. This is the kind of housing and business options that younger people are looking for when they're trying to choose a place to live. So, I mean, there's a little bit of a tension there, but it has just sort of heightened the focus on the city council, the decisions it's making about which kind of developments to grant and not.
I don't want to overblow the controversy around the mural in downtown Overland Park at that corner of like 80th and Santa Fe, I think. But I wonder if the questions about race and identity and what is the true like spirit of Overland Park that kind of got at. Do you think that is a part of why this election cycle in Overland Park is so fraught? Or no?
I haven't heard anything suggesting that, you know, racial issues or questions of racial representation have been at the forefront of any of these particular races. I mean, you had some people pushing back on the inclusion of those murals in downtown Overland Park, just because I think more than anything, they just don't like the idea of public art. You know, not everybody is going to like the way a mural looks, and yet everybody is going to look at it when they're in downtown Overland Park. By and large, though, I think those murals have been very well received, and definitely have added a pop of color to an area that was a little bit beige before.
So then what about Shawnee?
Shawnee has seen some of those same questions about economic development. So downtown Shawnee been kind of just limping along for several years, and the city has continued to try to find ways to spur redevelopment there. You do have kind of two factions in the city, people who think that the city should be really using economic development tools, tax incentives and things like that to attract more people into downtown Shawnee, balancing the expansion of the city out west. Again, same kind of tension that exists in Overland Park. New developments in sort of greenfield parts of the city versus, hey, how do we keep the original part of the city vibrant, attractive, and moving forward? So there's those same kind of issues. You know, Shawnee last week took up the idea of a non-discrimination ordinance for the first time. And you saw a ton of interest from people both for and opposed to that idea in Shawnee show up. It was a topic that came up quite frequently during the mayoral and the city council primaries over the past couple months here.
Yeah, and I noticed that your coverage in the Shawnee Mission Post included collecting statements from all the candidates about where they stand on non-discrimination ordinances, which was super interesting to me. Like, you could tell that all of these answers were very carefully crafted. Not that that's surprising, but I feel like I was able to read between the lines, even not having been at these meetings, about who they were trying to talk to, what kinds of concerns they were trying to appease.
Yeah, and taking a step back here, so these non-discrimination ordinances have been popping up on the radar of a bunch of these smaller suburban municipalities in Johnson County over the course of the past year. Back in 2014, the city of Roland Park was the first city to take this up. It took that governing body a period of several months and a lot of kind of contentious meetings to say, yes, we want to add protections for LGBTQ plus individuals for housing and for employment to our city ordinances.
Yeah, and let's just make it really clear, like, why this is happening right now.
Yeah, so There are no protections for sexual orientation and gender identity in state law in the state of Kansas. There aren't any of those protections in federal law. I believe 21 states do have ordinances that offer those protections, but these cities, I guess,
so the protections that exist for different religious groups or
race
different,
or
yeah,
creed, kind, all of that they aren't on the books in the state of Kansas. And so in Lawrence and Manhattan originally, several years ago, those city councils stepped forward and said, well, hey, if the state and the federal government aren't going to offer those protections, we as a city want to offer them here. So Roland Park was the first city in Johnson County to take this up, went through a really long process in 2014, ended up approving it. Kind of quiet for a few years. And then last year, the city of Prairie Village said, okay, we want to consider adding a non-discrimination ordinance as well. Took them a period of a couple months, several weeks, went back and forth, really dove into the details and the language and all that. They approved one last year. Kind of a domino effect. The city of Mission took one up, approved it. The city of Miriam took one up and approved it. A number of smaller cities took them up and approved it. The big five cities in Johnson County, however, to date had not passed them.
The big five being?
That is Overland Park, Olathe, Leawood, Lenexa, and Shawnee. These are cities that have 35,000 plus residents in them. After all of these other kind of smaller cities, I think eight or nine of these smaller cities had gone ahead and put these on the books. Now, the residents of the big five cities have kind of stepped forward and said, hey, we think it's time for you to consider them as well. And so Leawood, okay, again, just sort of a juxtaposition. The city of Leawood had not considered one of these. Resident came forward, presented the city council with a petition earlier this summer and said, listen, we would like for you to take this up. City of Leawood City Council convenes earlier this month, basically with zero drama, zero fanfare at all, says, yes, we believe that this is something we should do. City Council approves adding a non-discrimination ordinance in Leawood with no objections at all. The next week, the city of Shawnee in a committee takes up the same idea, and you had, you know, more than 100 people show up at this meeting, overflow in the room, more than 50 speakers discussing why they thought it was needed versus why they thought it was not needed, a meeting that went on for 5.5 hours. Ultimately, the council committee decided to advance the idea for further kind of final consideration, I believe next week, on a 5-2 vote. But it just shows you that, like, the way that this idea is being received really varies greatly from city to city.
Yeah, I mean, so your coverage in Shawnee, you're talking about there was a 5-hour meeting about this last week?
Correct, yeah.
5 hours. What did people talk about for 5 hours in Shawnee last week?
Well, okay, so basically the way it broke down was about 2/3 of the speakers, residents who came before the city council, said, we believe this is something that the city should take up. Adopting a non-discrimination ordinance with protections for sexual orientation and gender identity shows that we're a welcoming community. If the state and federal government are not going to offer these protections, we want to send the message that, you know, we don't care about that aspect of you. You are welcome here in the city of Shawnee. Shawnee also has a very, very active Catholic community. And so you had people standing up and saying, you know, we have sincerely held religious beliefs, and we do not believe that the city should be putting an ordinance on the book that could be interpreted as hindering our ability to, you know, exercise what we believe. You know, ultimately, you had the council side with the people who said, okay, you know, these are protections that everybody should have, and that you should not be at risk of being fired or denied access to an apartment just because you're gay. But I would anticipate that this meeting that's going to come up later this month will be just as sort of long and contentious.
So all of this, of course, matters on just a deeply human level to members of the LGBTQ community, their friends, their families, and their allies. It also might have an impact on the municipalities where these ordinances are in play, an economic impact.
Yes. I mean, that's one of the arguments in favor of them, that, listen, we want to show you that we are open for business in this city. We do not care about your sexual orientation, or anything like that. There is an argument, however, that people who have opposed these bills have made, that, you know, you are setting yourself up for having to enforce these. And so how do you investigate a claim of discrimination that is made? What are the punishments that you're going to enact? Who is in charge of sort of conducting that investigation? Is it done through the police department? Is it done through the municipal court system? I will say one of the things that people who support the idea of NDOs and people who oppose the idea of NDOs both seem to agree on is that this would be much better handled at the state or the federal level, and that having this patchwork of city ordinances is much less preferable to having a standard ordinance standard statute that would apply to every resident of Kansas.
It's interesting because when you talk about it having started in Lawrence and Manhattan, two college towns trying presumably to attract academics, professors. I mean, how big do you think that the economic issue is in all of this?
You know, when you have had members of the LGBTQ community step forward who are business owners, they have said, you know, even if this is symbolic, it means a lot to us to know that the city is willing to go out there and say it is not okay to discriminate against us. And so even if it's kind of difficult to really put a dollar figure on, well, because gay people will feel comfortable shopping here or opening businesses here, we are able to generate X, Y, or Z number of dollars. That's really difficult to actually illustrate. But I think the proponents say the symbolic nature is important and does make us feel like this is the kind of place we want to buy a home. This is the kind of place we want to do business. So,
yeah. Stepping back from both the elections and the really charged politics around non-discrimination ordinances, what do you think all of it says about change in Johnson County, period?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Johnson County has undergone a very, very sharp demographic shift over the course of the past 20 years. It is no longer a place where that is predominantly upper middle class white people. You've seen a lot more racial diversity. You've seen a lot more socioeconomic diversity. And with those, you've started to see more attention to issues that frankly just didn't get a whole lot of play or attention in recent years. And so I do think you're starting to see people stepping into public life there who are maybe more interested in social issues than in sort of just bottom line taxes and roads and things like that. There are some people that say, you know, hey, this just those kind of things are simply not the purview of city government. And we need to be sticking solely to, hey, let's mind the mill levy and make sure that trashes are picked up on time and things like that. You've had other candidates coming up and saying, listen, like, there are issues that our state and federal government, it's broken. It's not dealing with things that present themselves in people's day-to-day lives. And if they're not going to step up and do it, the city's going to have to do it too. You've seen this with climate change issues as well. You've had a lot of city council members and mayors in Northeast Johnson County join this Metro KC Climate Coalition that's looking at how cities can change their policies to be more green, basically. So,
something that strikes me is that we have been speaking now for 23 minutes and about 40 seconds about Johnson County, and we have not once talked about schools. And I don't think that that has ever happened when I've had you on before.
Well, it's the start of a new school year. You know, schools continue. The passage of the K-12 finance plan that passed Supreme Court muster last year sort of took a lot of the focus off of the struggles that schools were having. I will tell you that the budgeting process this year, Shawnee Mission School District, for example, is seeing millions more in funding than it did from the state government in previous years. It's still going to have a pretty hard time funding all the needs it has. Shawnee Mission has seen some of its Title I schools, the funding for Title I services go away. You know, Johnson County continues to sort of rely on the strength of its school districts, Olathe, Blue Valley, Spring Hill, Shawnee Mission.
Said one time in this very studio that public education was the religion of Johnson County.
I continue to believe that. Yeah, it absolutely is. I mean, it is the strength of those public schools is what brought people to Johnson County in the first place. It is what continues to bring people there, I think, first and foremost, combined with affordable housing. And so to the extent that those strong public schools continue to be the driver of pretty much all the strength that Johnson County has, they remain a focus. But, you know, I will say that passage of the K-12 funding bill last year did sort of offer sort of a relief valve for some of the pressures that they had been facing.
In your role, you report on all of these stories, but I'm guessing that readers and people you meet just on a daily basis also want to talk to you about what's going on because either they read something you wrote or they know that maybe, like, if they can put a bug in your ear, you'd pick up a story. I'm curious about, is there something that people are saying to you a lot right now that's sort of percolating in your mind about the story of of Johnson County and the municipalities you cover in the Shawnee Mission Post?
I think there has been, and this is across municipalities, there has been a push for more openness and transparency from city government in Johnson County. A lot of times these cities have had very sort of buttoned down cultures where there wasn't a ton of public comment or interaction about issues facing the community. Overland Park's a kind of a good example of that. I mean, you just in the past couple of weeks have had a couple members of the city council step up and say, you know, we don't actually offer an open mic opportunity to people at city council meetings. It's the only city in Johnson County that doesn't allow that. So, you know, basically if you're a resident and you want to have the city council hear you address whatever concern it might be, you didn't have a set form to do that at a city council meeting. So they're considering that now. But I think that's emblematic of a desire that people in Johnson County have for there to be more opportunities for involvement, more opportunities for engagement, and basically more channels for the people making decisions about where the cities go to hear directly from residents.
Is there something that might be slipping under the radar that's not getting talked about, that even though it matters a lot?
You know, as these schools are entering this kind of new era where technology is super, super pervasive, you're seeing the different school districts take varied approaches to how they are exposing kids to technology. Shawnee Mission School District 5 years ago implemented a one-to-one technology initiative where they provided an iPad or a MacBook to every one of their 28,000 or so students. Parents have not been super thrilled with the implementation of this by and large. And over the course of the past year, you've seen a lot of them step up and say, listen, we don't want our kids being on iPads on the bus. We don't want our kids being on iPads at recess. We think the district needs to step up more and help us manage these devices that it's given our kids. I think you're going to start seeing this issue about how technology is implemented in the classroom become a more and more prevalent issue.
Jay Center of the Shawnee Mission Post, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we check in with the editors of community newspapers throughout the metro to hear from them about big stories in their communities that the rest of us ought to be paying attention to. If you want to nominate a community newspaper to be part of the series, tweet us. We're at KCURCST. Up next, A Play at the Nelson brings the 30 Americans exhibit to a close. We'll hear more in a minute. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And my next guest is Michelle Tyrene Johnson. She's the race, identity, and culture reporter here at KCUR. She has filled in for me sometimes when I've been on vacation, but she is also a playwright. And she's been commissioned by the Nelson Atkins Museum to write a play taking inspiration from the art in the 30 Americans exhibit. It's a huge exhibit that's traveling the country. It's here in town now, but not for long, just through this weekend. And one of the last events is this play Michelle wrote, Coloring Within the Lines. It debuts on Friday. Hi, Michelle.
Hey, Gina.
So first of all, 30 Americans, for people who have not seen it, how would you describe the exhibit?
It is an exhibit of only Black artists. And it's what's really cool about it is the exhibit has been taking place in major museums for 10 years now. So this is sort of a traveling exhibition of Black artists who do just a range of really awesome things, from the head scratch, like all art, from the head scratching to the, oh my God, that is just so amazing and fabulous that someone who, you know, inhabits the same universe as I do can do that.
So you were asked to write a play somehow using the material in the exhibit for inspiration, but you were asked before the art even came to town. What's your journey been like getting to know the art and finding your own story to tell in it?
Well, so I was commissioned about a year ago. I mean, time just sort of folds in on itself. I think it was about a year ago. And you're right. It was, I mean, they provided me with the book on the exhibition because, as I said, it's been up traveling for 10 years. And they then sent me photos of the art that they were going to put in the Kansas City exhibition, because there's a basically a pool of art that the Rebel family provides, and each city's museum picks what pieces they're going to use. So once they picked the pieces, they sent me photographs of it, which, you know, still doesn't do it any justice. So I just know that what happened for me is that in February, when Nelson had their big rollout event where they talked about all the events that were going to take place during the exhibition, and everybody kept saying, you know, African American, you know, in that really cultured way that people say when they're just really talking black folks. I mean, you talk, okay, whatever, African American, you know. And I use the word black because African American isn't always accurate. Just because someone is dark skinned and looks black doesn't mean that they are of African descent. I have plenty of friends who aren't, you know. So I just knew that my play somehow was going to just be black, black, blackity black, 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 black. And I even have a line in the play that says that for that reason, just like, well, let's just put it out there.
Yes. Okay. I really want to dig into that some more, like a lot more. Before we get too far into it, can you give just a quick synopsis of the play you ended up writing, and then we'll pick it right back up where you just left off?
Okay. So it's a 30-minute play, and I take two pieces of art and I bring them to life, and they...
Which pieces of art are you willing to say?
I guess I'll say it's it's the one by Rashad Johnson that is the brother with the big afro. It's a black and white photograph with the big afro and the checked jacket and the white or pale gray tie, and a one by Micheline Thomas. I think I'm pronouncing her first name correctly. That's very sensuous. If you can see the actual painting, it's a lot of bling and painting. It really pops when you see it in person, which I had not seen before I wrote the play. I didn't see the exhibit. The cast and crew went together last week for the first time, and that was really interesting to see that things I wrote in the play I didn't really even know, but were sort of emotionally accurate. And so we do cover up our actress, because in the painting, he's a little bit nude, but
just a little bit.
But Alexa Siafi Apt, who is both the stage manager and the assistant director, she helped clothe Karis Harrington properly, so that we just have the illusion of nudity, not actual nudity in Nelson.
And so you created, you took inspiration from these two pieces, and what ended up being kind of like the source of drama.
So, without getting too much into the actual play, because I need the 500 people who signed up to come see it to actually come see it and be somewhat surprised. The two pieces are in the storage room before the exhibit is up, and in the world I've created, because as a playwright, you know, as any kind of writer, as you know, as a writer, when it's fiction, you can create whatever world you want. Right. So, you know, we have flying monkeys and scarecrows who talk or whatever. In my play, the pieces of art, when they are, they can talk, they can speak to one another. The pieces can speak to one another.
So one of the conversations they have, and we're not going to get into the details of it, but it is about this word choice question, the words people use to describe race and blackness in particular. And those choices do position us in a certain way with the people we're talking about and the people we're talking to. What do you think, even just when it's a split second decision, that decision of choosing African or American or black really says?
I just think, I mean, I personally hate the phrase political correctness. I think that that what people mean by political correctness is me having to stop to think about how I say something because it might offend a group that I'm not a part of, as opposed to when it's possible offense to the group you're in, you just call that rudeness. But so I think that oftentimes that when people pause over whether to use black versus African American, so many times white people in general and black people, sometimes when talking to white people, because I've done it, default to African American because that sounds as if they're trying to be more sensitive, which I'm not saying that most people who do that aren't trying to be more sensitive. It's just kind of irritating when people are sort of offended because a black person calls himself black. Because to me,
have you had that happen? People who are
Tell
me, can you recount a tale? Or are there?
I mean, they're just, you know, it's, well, I just think that sounds harsh to the ear. Well, do you think white sounds harsh to the ear? I mean, my philosophy is black and white aren't actual descriptors because I'm not black, you're not white. But yet if somebody came in here, they would describe us as a black woman and a white woman. So they're just shorthand descriptors as opposed to being about anything any deeper. I mean, that's all that is. If I go to a restaurant and I'm saying that I'm looking for a friend, which is a whole nother conversation about how people just assume that if I'm looking for a friend in a restaurant, they assume it's a black friend. But, you know, it's just a descriptor. Like I may say, you know, a white friend who's wearing glasses, you know, who's a little bit younger than me. But people just get caught up. I mean, some black people don't like to be called black because of the connotations. Because black, again, I'm not black, you know. I mean, they want to be. But my thing is just ask people.
What they want to be called.
What they want to be called, you know. I mean, even in journalism, you know, our guide, when we're referring to people, says we call people black. Which, again, I personally think is accurate because not every person who's black is African American.
So the characters in your play, as we've mentioned, talk about this. And has that gotten the members of your cast talking about these subtleties of African American versus black in their own lives?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, one is the play covers more than just that. I mean, it covers several other topics, you know. But also, black people don't really need to discuss what we are called. No disrespect, but what black people are called, for the most part, is a conversation that we don't need to have among ourselves. I mean, unless there's a specific reason for it. I mean, just like I don't have to sit around and discuss with people who wear glasses life wearing glasses. I mean, it's
though we should do that sometime.
Right, we should do that sometime. We really should. But, you know, my point in being inspired by it is I just think that I wanted to write a play that was, and the Nelson was very supportive of this, that was culturally provocative without being offensive. And so the play is very direct about race and access to the arts. Like one of the things that really sat with me in writing this piece is how the Nelson Art Gallery physically sits on the dividing line of race and class in Kansas City. You go in one direction, we're talking, it's a black neighborhood. You go in the opposite direction, in just a few blocks, it's the Country Club Plaza. And that line, that distinction is something that actually impacts how many people want to even bother walking into Nelson Art Gallery.
Okay, we're going to pick right back up with this, okay, Michelle? My guest is Michelle Tyrene Johnson. She wrote the play Coloring Within the Lines. It'll be at the Nelson this Friday, and we are going to talk more about access to art in just a minute on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and my guest is Michelle Tyrene Johnson, KCUR reporter and award-winning playwright. Her newest play is Coloring Within the Lines. It'll be at the Nelson this Friday as part of the 30 Americans exhibit, now on view, but only through this weekend. Hi again, Michelle.
Hey, Gina.
So you were just talking about the Nelson Atkins sitting on the racial dividing line of Kansas City, essentially, with the city looking one way when you look mm-hmm. to the east and another way when you look to the west from that magnificent lawn.
And it really is a thing. I mean, again, there are black people who have never walked into Nelson Art Gallery for no other reason than they think it's not for them. One of the things that I think is really just touches my heart is Robert Cobbett III, whose nickname that we all call Trey, who's in my play. He had an event because to see the exhibit itself is, I think, $18. And he had an event that's whole purpose was to raise money so that black kids who did not have the financial access to see it could go see it. And he raised enough for 76 kids to go see.
And
that exhibit.
Have they done it yet? Does he know what the responses were? What the impact was?
I mean, you'd have to talk to him about that. But no, I mean, it was big, because if you're not going into a museum because you think the place is not for you, and in part you think the place is not for you because you're made to believe from your history books, your art, whatever you're looking at, that only white people are going to be on the walls, then I have no doubt. I mean, I'm a fairly cultured, educated woman, and even I, when I went in and saw that exhibit in a major museum like the Nelson, which I've gone to my entire life, even as a kid, there's something that is just, I can't even put an emotional word on it, and I should because I'm a writer, but it is something to see you, even if some of the things you don't quite relate to, like that dirt, that one piece that's a rug that looks like it could be coming from my house. But even if you don't relate to every piece, there are pieces that will blow you away. But it's all reflective of Black artists putting Black work before the public.
I would also think just that having that variety and having the thing you relate to and the thing you don't relate to, but all sort of like a kaleidoscope of your world, that's...
It's awesome. I mean, like we had rehearsal last night at Nelson, and I was able to be lucky enough to have Krishan McKinney give myself and Alexa a little mini second tour.
She works in the Nelson's Education Department.
Yes, and she's amazing. And she gave us a little second private tour at night, which was totally exciting to me at the museum at night with nobody else. And so I saw pieces that I hadn't even noticed when I was there last week that struck me in this whole different emotional way. So, I mean, that's, and so even to the house music I play when you're coming in to sit down to Friday night, it's, again, I deliberately put the lens on Black people, even to the point where it's Black people that you may never have heard of. So when you walk in, I'm going to be blaring some Kendrick Lamar, some Lizzo, some, you know, Michelle Indicello. I mean, I'm going to be like, this is going to be, again, I want the whole experience from start to finish being, okay, I stepped in another culture for just an hour and a half of my life.
So, wait, do you?
If you're white, that is.
Right.
If you're black, that's just, you know, Monday or Friday.
The physical location of the Nelson being where it is. Do you think that there is an opportunity in that?
There's always an opportunity, but again, it's as much psychological as it is physical. And psychologically, I just think that if somebody thinks that something is not for them, then they don't. No one wants to be rejected. No one, as is those of us. I mean, this is a whole another separate sociological societal conversation. As it is, if you're Black in America, I mean, just sometimes going to work every day is a matter of having to bring yourself in a space that is primarily white space. And so when you talk about making choices to engage in art and doing that, that's a whole nother thing.
How do you think that the art world can actively welcome everyone in a different way? Like the Nelson isn't going to be able to change how art period appears, but they can change how they as an institution maybe reach out.
I mean, this is a good start. I mean, Krishan tells me that this is one of the most successful exhibitions they've ever had. That sure, there's some people, it gets a share of criticisms from some people who because some of the pieces are shocking. I mean, they have like a KKK art piece that's in a room that's just really, I mean, it's hard to even see, but that is as much a part of the exhibition as seeing the pretty, lovely floral pieces that are up on the wall. I mean, all of that is because like any artist, regardless of any culture, it's all about people expressing what culture they are representing. I mean, I even have one of the characters say something that whatever whatever is in the environment of the artist is what helps create the art they create, which is what is part of them as the subjects of their art.
Michelle Tyrene Johnson wrote a play, Coloring Within the Lines, and it'll be at the Nelson this Friday. But Michelle, one of the other themes that I know you have been diving into in this play is how women are often objectified in art, in the long history of art.
And yeah, because Miss Mona Lisa even makes an appearance. As the character refers to it, the most famous white lady in art history. But it is. It's a little bit about the theme of how women, both as subjects of art, but just in general, in society, how pretty, how our looks, that's our currency. And that, you know, the prettier you are, especially if you're young, the greater your currency in society. And that's not just an American thing. That's in any society at any time of existence. And so I wanted to get into that a little bit because, I mean, that's no less a case in an exhibition by Black artists.
So how do you go about translating that into something that unfolds on the stage?
I don't know. I guess I just have, you know, as a journalist doing my job here, I have to deal with facts. I have to deal with the reality of how things unfold and what people actually say. But, you know, that's the beauty of being any kind of fiction writer, particularly a playwright. It's about what themes are important to me, what story needs to be told, and then just creating the people or the objects, in this case, objects played by people, that tell that story. And I mean, there were so many art pieces that I could have written about, but for some reason, I wanted to have a man and a woman, and I wanted to talk not just about race, but about gender, but about access. And I wanted to do it in a way that is engaging, because the primary job of anybody, journalism and art, that's what they have in common, is don't bore me. You know, tell me what I need to know as I need to know it, but don't bore me while you're doing it.
So when you think about the play that you ultimately created and the way that it's been sort of supported, that you've been commissioned to do this, that it sounds like this is an arts institution that is welcoming some level of critique.
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, because I was conscious of the fact that they're paying me to write something, I mean, I wasn't going to go whole hog and like basically stand on their front yard and scream obscenities of them. So, you know, it's not an attack of Nelson at all. It's a conversation through the plot about art in general, as race in particular, is an issue. Because, I mean, that's all the arts. I mean, I deal with that in theater. I mean, theater in this city is primarily white institutions, and white institutions trying to figure out sometimes how to be inclusive. And some of them do it better than others. Some of them don't do it at all. But everyone wants credit for looking like they're trying.
Okay,
and
can
I'd
we
argue
step back
that
a
that's,
second.
Yes.
What does it look like to do it better, for one institution to do it better than the other?
For one, it's having, if we're talking theater, but this also includes museums, dance companies, it's having all kinds of people on stage, not just Black people, so you check a box, you know, all the, you know, various races, various cultures. And it's not just doing it during, like, for Black people, let me specifically talk about Black people, it's not just doing it in February, okay, so that you can go, great, I had a Black History Month play, even if you don't call it that. It's about knowing that all year long, there is a repository of great, talented, hardworking people that want to be part of your entire program, not just your slated programming.
So then when you think about art museums, this exhibition, you seem pretty on board with what they've done here, although this access piece with the dollar amount at $18 for admission is a sticking point, but that overall this is a good step. Yeah. What would be a next step?
I mean, in all fairness, I mean, they charge for all their major exhibits.
Totally.
So my point isn't that they just charge for this. It's, I mean, museums charge. And, I mean, don't get me wrong. Most of the time it's free. Most people can go and it's free. I have more than once gone to a museum just to clear my head, walked in, walked out.
The permanent collection on view in most of the galleries.
Exactly.
Is free, and then the special
exactly. But I mean, I think that this is, it's always a start when you open the door to something that's off the conventional, because it's like a playwright friend of mine posted the other day, where she's Latina. She's a Latina playwright, and a white woman audience member was saying how she would not feel comfortable going to a play that was about the Latinx experience because she just feels as if she couldn't relate to it. And my friend says to her, well, are you Jewish? And she goes, no, but you don't have any problem going to see what's the famous play? Fiddler on the Roof. You have no problem with going to see Fiddler on the Roof. And she goes, well, no, that's just a good story. And my friend's point was, but everybody writes good stories, and the failure to look at all of us as having a humanity worthy of writing about and being seen is what creates in our society the dehumanization of how we see certain members of our society. So if somebody can go see a culture that they know nothing about except going through an exhibit, I think that's a win-win. You know, the artists have had their work seen by more people, and a person is seeing an aspect of humanity that they would not necessarily have seen before, whether it's a piece of art, a play, a book, a novel, a dance, going to the Alvin Ailey dance, whatever. It's just about all of us needing to get outside of our boxes and our bubbles and seeing that just because something isn't exactly like my experience doesn't mean that it isn't beautiful and engaging to participate in and to see.
So thinking about how your story with this exhibit and this play began, which was that you started with a book and you were looking at photos of the art, and then you finally just very recently got to see the actual art in person. I feel like that's essentially the journey most people take in this day and age on some level, is that you see on the website or you see a postcard and you start to get familiar with what some of the images might be, but then you find yourself standing in front of it, and so many times the expectations are just blown out of the water. And I'm curious if there was a piece in this exhibit that just for you as a person, not even as a playwright, just you saw it in person and something shifted. I would love to hear the story of that piece and what it meant to you.
Well, I mean, the obvious piece that many people probably have seen, like displayed on the Nelson website, is the and I think I'm going to butcher his name because if you, as a guest host and as a guest, I butcher names. Kehinde Wiley.
You got it.
And he has this piece that is it's his interpretation of a famous art piece. But in his piece, it's a black man who is spread out, and there's like a piece of cloth around his waist, and it's like flowers around him, and it is in person. I mean, honestly, if Krishan and security didn't kick me out, I could have just like slept on the floor and woke up to that, because that piece is so massive and amazing, and like every little piece of it, just even looking at how he put paint on the canvas was just crazy pants. I mean, it's just like, what? I mean, it was just so epic. And there's no way you could get that from just looking at a photograph. There is no way. I even jokingly said, what truck did they strap that on top of? Because it was that big.
I think that the next city that this exhibit goes to should have crazy pants as the quote that goes with the mailers and everything.
There you go.
Crazy pants, Michelle Tyrene Johnson. Michelle, our time is up. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Gina.
Michelle is the race, identity, and culture reporter for KCUR, and her play, Coloring Within the Lines, is going to be at the Nelson Atkins Museum this Friday at 6:30. You can find out more at nelson-atkins.org. That's a wrap. We'll have the audio from today's show available on demand at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. That's where you'll find all our past shows, including the conversation we had yesterday about access to bras for girls in low-income households. And on Tuesday, we spoke with Simon Tam, the frontman for a band called The Slants, about his experiences defending that band name before the U.S. Supreme Court. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we're talking about hot dogs. Just hot dogs with the food critics. We'll also be sharing some tips on creative grillables if hot dogs aren't your thing. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell and Ann Kniggendorf. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.